Dominican gang known as the DDP. It stands for Dominicans Don't Play, which is something of an understatement, as it turns out. He laughed nervously. And yes, I did hire LeBron. But not to kill Lenny. Grace hesitated.
Go on.
They said they were debt collectors, legitimate businessmen. That's how they described themselves. They came to the house and showed me pictures of women being raped and mutilated. They said Maria would be next. Then, a month before the Quorum Ball, one of them showed up at the office. He brought a severed finger, wrapped in kitchen towel. Andrew closed his eyes at the memory. I'd paid off what Maria owed by then, but they still came back for more. They wanted interest, hundreds of thousands. It was never going to end. I couldn't go to the police in case they found out about the money I'd stolen from Quorum. So I contacted LeBron. He and his people took care of it. Grace tried to take this in. When she'd read the file entry about Andrew's embezzlement and learned of his contacts with the New York gang, she was sure she found her man. It all made sense. The thefts Lenny had discovered were the tip of the iceberg. In reality, Andrew must have been siphoning off billions from Quorum's coffers, cooking the books to make it look like Lenny was the thief. Then he'd hired a professional hitman to murder Lenny, and stood by and watched while Grace took the blame. But listening to Andrew talk, watching the horror on his face as he remembered the threats made to Maria, she was convinced he was telling her the truth. Andrew Preston was not Lenny's killer. It was a crushing blow. Lenny was like a father to me, Grace, and I betrayed him. I carry the guilt of that with me till the day I die, but I never wanted him dead. Not like Jack Warner. Grace had read Davy's file on Jack, too. She knew about the gambling debts and Lenny's refusal to pay them, but it hardly amounted to a motive for murder. Besides, Jack's alibi was rock solid. The Coast Guard had rescued him miles away from where Lenny's boat was found.
Jack was mad at Lenny. I know that.
Mad?
Andrew looked surprised. He hated him, Grace. Lenny had Warner over a barrel. He knew all of his dirty little secrets. Everyone in the Senate knew that Jack Warner was Quorum's puppet, that he voted however Lenny Brookstein told him to vote. Lenny squeezed Jack like a wet rag. The guy couldn't breathe. Grace looked disbelieving.
I'm sure it wasn't like that. Lenny would never have blackmailed Jack. He would never have blackmailed anyone.
Andrew Preston smiled. It was a flash of the old Grace. Unquestioning, adoring, convinced that Lenny could do no wrong. Not that he blamed her. Andrew knew better than anyone what it was like to love someone so much you would defend them against all reason. Grace, he said gently, whatever happened to Lenny, it happened at sea, and it happened on the day of the storm. Jack was also out on the water that day, remember? Grace remembered. Like Michael Gray, Jack Warner was an expert sailor. Expert enough to somehow board Lenny's boat and kill him? To dump him overboard and make it look like an accident? It was possible. Try to find a lady called Jasmine, said Andrew. That's the best advice I can give you. She might make you see things in a different light.
Mitch had gone to the Prestons' apartment on impulse. He'd hoped to quiz Andrew about his alleged embezzlement from Quorum, but was met instead by a hysterical Maria. It was almost midnight, and Andrew hadn't called. No one had seen him since he left the office at 5. She'd called the police, but no one took her seriously. Mitch did.
"Let me pour you a brandy, Mrs. Preston."
Had Grace taken the law into her own hands? By now, she would know that Andrew had been stealing from Lenny. What if she'd abducted him? Or worse? If Grace got it into her head that Andrew was behind Lenny's death, there was no telling what she might be capable of. When the apartment door opened and Andrew Preston walked in, Mitch was at least as relieved as Maria. Andrew's shirt was bloodied, and his nose badly bruised, but he seemed calm. Unlike his wife, who flung herself melodramatically into his arms.
"Oh, Andy! Andy, what happened? I've been out of my mind. Where have you been?"
"At the hospital. I'm fine, Maria. I had a slight accident, that's all."
"What sort of accident?"
"Ridiculous, really. I slipped and fell in the rain and landed flat on my face on the sidewalk. I would have called, but I was stuck in ER for hours. You know what those places are like. I didn't want to worry you, darling."
"Well, you did worry me. The police are here."
Maria gestured towards Mitch. Andrew Preston recognized him from the TV reports as the guy who was looking for Grace. He did his best to sound nonchalant.
"My goodness, does one errant husband warrant a search party these days?
I'm sorry if I caused any trouble, detective."
"Not at all, Mr. Preston. I actually came to talk with you about another matter, but it can wait. I'm glad to see you home safe. Look, this probably is going to sound like a ridiculous question, but I don't suppose Grace Brookstein has tried to contact you by any chance? In the last 48 hours?
Andrew looked puzzled.
"Grace? Contact me? No. Why on earth would she do that?"
"No reason," said Mitch. "I'll see myself out."
Later, in bed, Andrew watched his wife sleep.
"I love you so much, my angel."
He'd been touched by Maria's concern when he got home. Perhaps things were going to be all right between them after all. He considered telling Detective Connors the truth about Grace and what had happened that afternoon, but only for a moment. Grace had spared his life and forgiven him his sins. The least he could do was return the favor. If Lenny really had been murdered, Andrew wished Grace luck in finding his killer. Whatever the world might think, Lenny Brookstein had been a good man. Reaching across the bed for Maria, Andrew pulled her close, inhaling the heady scent of her body. The faint whiff of aftershave he detected as well brought tears to his eyes. Andrew Preston never wore aftershave. Chapter 23. Jasmine Delavigne admired her naked body in the mirror. She was 24 years old with smooth café au lait skin, long, slender legs, and a new set of perfect silicone breasts, a birthday present from a powerful client. Cupping them lovingly in her hands, Jasmine thought, "No, he's more than a client. He's my lover. I adore him." It was unlike Jasmine to get attached to the men who pay to share her bed.
The daughter of a French businessman and a Persian princess, Jasmine Delavigne didn't need the money she earned as a hooker. She did it for the thrill. Just knowing that rich, powerful men, men with beautiful wives and even more beautiful mistresses, found her irresistible, so intoxicating that they would pay for the privilege of bedding her, gave Jasmine an incredible high. It was years since she dipped into her trust fund. Her Fifth Avenue apartment, her vintage MG convertible, her wardrobe full of couture dresses and $1,000-a-pair shoes. Jasmine's perfect body had paid for them all. Other people might call her a whore. People like her father, who lavished all his attention on Jasmine's mother and never noticed his daughter's efforts to please him. But Jasmine didn't care what they thought. "I'm a feminist. I fuck who I like, when I like, because I like. I answer to no one." She wandered into her dressing room and picked out some underwear. Chocolate brown silk La Perla panties and a matching camisole. Classy and feminine, just how he likes it. It had been weeks since Jasmine had seen him, and she was excited. There were others, of course. All her clients were good-looking, successful men, and all of them were good in bed. Jasmine Delavigne was the best, and she only worked with the best. But none of the other men had gotten to her the way that he did. The buzzer rang. "He's early. He wants this as much as I do." Jasmine opened the door coolly, like the princess that she was. "Hello, darling." He grabbed her by the throat. "Take your fucking clothes off, now." Jasmine's pupils dilated with excitement. "I've missed you so much." "Please, no!" Gavin Williams tightened the knots around Grace Brookstein's wrists. Then he lifted the cane and brought it down hard across the backs of her legs. Two livid red welts joined the others. Gavin Williams smiled. "I ask you again, Grace, where is the money?" She was crying, begging. Lenny Brookstein's wife, his most treasured possession, was begging him, Gavin Williams, for mercy. But Gavin Williams would show no mercy. "Let the sinners be consumed out of earth, and let the wicked be no more." He felt himself getting hard. He lifted the cane again.
"Excuse me, sir. Are you okay?"
Gavin Williams's fantasy evaporated. He was back at his desk at the SIBL, the Science, Industry, and Business Library on Madison Avenue. The librarian was standing over him. Stupid, meddlesome bitch. Why couldn't she mind her own business? "I'm fine."
"Are you sure? You look very flushed. Would you like me to open a window or something?"
"No," Gavin snapped. The old woman got the point and returned to her seat. It was ridiculous being forced to work in a public library. After Harry Bain had summarily dismissed him from the Quorum Task Force, Gavin's bureau chief had insisted that he take a paid leave of absence.
"You're stressed out, Agent Williams. You need some time off. Happens to all of us."
"It happens to weak idiots like you, you mean. Not to me."
"I'm fine. I'm ready for service."
"Take the vacation, Gavin, okay? We'll call you in a couple of months." A couple of months?
Gavin knew what was going on. John Merrivale had been conspiring against him, poisoning as well. They all think I'm crazy, obsessive, but I'll show them. When Grace Brookstein leads me to that money, they'll be eating their words. I'm close. I can feel it. Gavin Williams pulled an antiseptic wipe out of his briefcase and started cleaning the spot where the librarian's fingers had touched his desk. Then he closed his eyes and tried to recapture his fantasy. Grace Brookstein, at his mercy, tied up like an animal. It was no use. She was gone.
Sir, take a look at this.
Mitch leaned over the younger detective's computer screen. You asked me to do some digging on Senator Warner. This email just came in from Vice Squad. Mitch read the email.
No one ever followed this up?
It appears not, sir. Senator Warner's a big supporter of NYPD causes.
I'll bet he is.
This is all off the record. My buddy in Vice was doing me a favor. I told him we'd handle it sensitively.
Do you have an address for the girl?
Yes, sir. It's a pretty swanky address, too. The detective clicked to another window. Do you think maybe we should send a female officer out there first? We don't want to spook her. Jack Warner sat in the back of his limousine, feeling the adrenaline course through his veins. Being with Jasmine again, touching her, fucking her, gorging himself on her body, it was the best feeling in the world. Knowing that the whole of America idolized him as a Christian conservative, a walking embodiment of righteousness and family values, only added to the thrill. Jack remembered Fred Farrell's advice to him about his gambling. I get it. It's a turn-on. All this risk. But is it as much of a turn-on as being the next president of the United States? That's what you have to ask yourself, Jack. You could lose everything. Ah, yes. But that was the thrill, wasn't it? Knowing you could lose everything. Fred Farrell knew about the gambling and the extramarital flings, but he didn't know about Jasmine. Only one person had ever known about Jasmine. And that person was a rotting, worm-eaten corpse by the name of Lenny Brookstein. Jasmine Delavine poured tea from a silver pot into two porcelain cups. She handed one of them to the policewoman. The officer, a nerdy, pale young woman with short black hair and thick plastic-framed glasses, looked around the sumptuous apartment and thought, I'm in the wrong business. Sugar?
Oh, no thank you. You have a beautiful place.
Thanks. I've worked hard for it. Jasmine leaned back on the Ralph Lauren suede couch and crossed her long legs demurely. So, you want to know about Senator Warner? When the female cop had showed up unannounced, asking questions about Jack and his relationship to Leonard Brookstein, Jasmine's first reaction was panic. Her second was loyalty. Jasmine loved Jack. She could not betray him. But it was her third reaction, self-interest, that eventually won the day. This could be her chance to pry Jack away from his wife at last. He only stayed with Honor because she was necessary to his political ambitions. It stood to reason that if those political ambitions were to die,
and so would his marriage.
How long have the two of you known each other?
Jasmine took a sip of tea. Socially, about 5 years. We've been lovers for 3. Cookie? This girl's a piece of work.
No, thank you. You say lovers.
You're right. I should probably clarify. Senator Warner is a client of mine. He pays for my services. She spoke without a hint of shame. Nevertheless, I would characterize our relationship as a love match. We adore each other.
I see. So Senator Warner confides in you?
Absolutely.
I wonder, did he ever talk to you about Lenny Brookstein?
He did. Lenny knew about us. He was the only one who knew.
Jack told him?
No, God, no. He found out somehow. Lenny Brookstein was blackmailing Jack. He was a vicious, bullying man, and he made Jack's life hell. When I heard he'd killed himself, I was pleased. It couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. The policewoman sat up, startled by the girl's bluntness. Jasmine noticed the reaction.
I'm sorry, she shrugged.
I could lie about it, but I don't see the point. I hated Lenny Brookstein. Jack and I both did. He was a manipulator and a fake.
Miss Delavine, in your opinion, did Senator Warner hate Lenny Brookstein enough to want to have him killed or to kill him himself?
Jasmine smiled. The policewoman thought, even her teeth are perfect. Did he hate him enough?
Absolutely.
Lenny was threatening to destroy everything Jack had ever worked for. He would force Jack to swing votes in Quorum's favor, back when they were rewriting all that hedge fund legislation, you remember? The policewoman nodded. Every time Lenny would tell Jack, "This is it. One more vote and you're off the hook." But every time he would come back for more, squeezing and squeezing. Jasmine shook her head angrily. Jack hated Lenny Brookstein with good reason, but he didn't kill him.
You sound sure of that.
I am sure. Jack was supposed to be out sailing that day, you see, the day of the storm, when Lenny Brookstein went missing. The policewoman looked at her notes.
That's right. He did go sailing. The Nantucket Coast Guard rescued him 6 miles off Sankaty Head. He returned to the Brookstein estate at around 6 o'clock that night.
The Coast Guard didn't rescue Jack. At least, not in the way that you mean.
I'm sorry?
The policewoman frowned.
I don't follow.
Jack never took the boat out. He was with me all day in a beachside cottage in Syokonset. The Coast Guard covered for him.
You mean the Coast Guard helped Senator Warner to give a false alibi? They lied?
Jasmine laughed, a low, sensual vibration that brought her whole body to life. Don't look so shocked. It happens all the time. Senator Warner's a powerful man. People scratch Jack's back so that he'll scratch theirs. I'd have thought, in your profession, you'd be used to that sort of thing. I certainly am in mine. Jasmine politely showed the officer to the door. As she left, Jasmine asked her, "So, the police think Lenny Brookstein might have been murdered." I've been following the case, but I hadn't heard anything about murder.
It's a possibility we're considering.
Do you think that means things will come out now? About me and Jack? Jasmine cocked her head to one side, hopefully. The policewoman thought,
So that's it. She wants people to know. She's hoping to force the senator's hand so he'll leave his wife. I don't know, Ms. Delavine. That's not for me to say.
Jasmine leaned forward conspiratorially. My money's on his mistress. That woman is hard as nails. The policewoman smiled.
I think you must be mistaken. Mr. Brookstein didn't have a mistress.
Sure he did. Connie Gray, his sister-in-law. They were lovers till Lenny abandoned her and went crawling back to his wife. Didn't you know? Chapter 24
Police! Open the door, Miss Delavine!
Jasmine sighed. Again? What do they want this time? She opened the door.
Hey, I know you, don't I?
Downstairs in the lobby, Grace locked the door of the ladies' room. Removing her black wig and eyeglasses, she stepped out of her police uniform, folded it neatly, and placed it in the toilet cistern. Only after she'd replaced the lid of the cistern and straightened her own clothes did she collapse onto the floor and cry.
No. Not Lenny. Not my own Lenny. With my own sister? He couldn't.
She cast her mind back. Lenny and Connie always had gotten along. They were kindred spirits in a way, both tough, both ambitious. The opposite of me. She remembered the pair of them dancing at the Quorum Ball, deep in conversation. Connie arguing with Lenny on the beach in Nantucket, then storming off in tears.
I thought he was just comforting her because of Michael. Because of all the money that they'd lost, how could I have been so blind?
Grace didn't care about Connie. Her sisters were long since dead to her. But Lenny? Grace's memory of their marriage, of Lenny's love for her, was the one true thing she had left in this world. Without that, there was no hope, no meaning, no point to any of it. Without that love, the anguish was unbearable. She cried out to the heavens.
Oh, Lenny, tell me it isn't true.
But Grace heard nothing, only the echo of her own words in the silence. Jasmine smiled at the hunky blonde cop. Usually, she only went for wealthy men. But in Detective Mitch Connor's case, she might be persuaded to make an exception.
I'd like to talk about your relationship with Senator Warner.
Certainly. Although I'm not sure how much more I can help you. I already told your colleague everything I know. Mitch frowned.
My colleague?
Yeah, she was just here.
She?
She was asking me all about Jack and what happened on Nantucket the weekend that Lenny Brookstein disappeared. Didn't you send her? Mitch's mouth went dry. He bolted for the elevator, pounding his fist on the call button. It seemed to take forever. Should I wait or take the stairs? Fuck it. He pushed open the emergency exit door and bounded down the stairs, three at a time. Bursting into the lobby, he looked around. Empty. He ran out onto the street, frantically looking to the left and right. Fifth Avenue was busy.
The street was choked with afternoon traffic and the sidewalk was full of people. Mitch weaved among them, holding out his badge like a talisman, grabbing every petite woman he came across, scanning the features of every woman he passed. It was no good. Grace Brookstein was gone.
Chapter 25. As soon as he realized Grace had given him the slip, Mitch sprinted back up to Jasmine's apartment. "What did you tell her? I want to know everything, word for word." It was quite a conversation. Mitch was used to hearing Lenny Brookstein derided as a fraud and a coward, but in all of the media's vitriolic portrayals, there had never been so much as a whisper about his sleeping around. As for a full-blown affair with his wife's sister, it just seemed so out of character. No wonder the policewoman had left in such a hurry. Mitch tried to figure out what Grace's next move would be. After so many weeks on the case, he was starting to feel as if he was in her head, almost as if they were psychically connected in some way. It was weird. Technically, they barely knew each other, didn't know each other. Yet there were times when Mitch felt closer to Grace Brookstein than he had to any of his past lovers, even Helen. Her first instinct, he felt sure, would be to head straight to Connie's house for a confrontation. But then what? Would common sense kick in? Showing up at her sister's place would be insanely risky. On the other hand, Grace had robbed Davy Bucola at gunpoint. Her appetite for risk seemed to be growing by the day. Mitch had interviewed both Grace's sisters immediately after her escape from Bedford. It was routine procedure to contact family, just in case a suspect tried to make contact. He remembered the way that both Honor and Connie had washed their hands of Grace like a pair of Lady Macbeths, abandoning her utterly in her time of need. Fair-weather friends were bad enough, but Grace seemed to have been cursed by fair-weather family. If Lenny really had traded a looker like Grace for an ice maiden like Connie Gray, he must have needed his head read. Mitch thought back to his encounter with Grace on the subway at Times Square. He'd come so close to catching her that day, but it wasn't his disappointment that he remembered. It was the look on Grace's face, that haunting combination of vulnerability and strength. Despite her exhaustion and the baggy, drab clothes she was wearing, there was something uniquely compelling about her. In some ways, she reminded Mitch of Helen back in the early, happy days of their marriage. Both women had an inner beauty, an innate femininity that drew men to them like moths to a flame. Connie Gray was the exact opposite. Connie's features might be regular and her figure toned and trim, but she was about as feminine as a sumo wrestler. Maybe that's what Lenny wanted. A tranny version of his wife. Now that really would be sick. Michael Gray answered the door. "Detective, this is a surprise." Mitch thought the same thing everyone thought when they met Michael. "You're a straight-up, old-fashioned, decent man. You're too good for these people." "Do you have news about Grace?" "Nothing concrete. We're pursuing some new lines of inquiry. I wondered if I might speak with your wife again." "Of course. I'll see if I can find her."
"It's all right, Mike. I'm here."
Connie appeared in the entryway. Mitch thought, maybe I was a little harsh. In a pretty floral print dress, her blonde hair drawn back in an Alice band, she looked a lot more attractive than he remembered her. Behind her, an adorable tow-headed boy was pushing a wooden train along the floor.
through the double doors to Mitch's right. An older, darker boy was practicing the piano. The whole thing looked like a scene from a Currier and Ives print. Too good to be true? Connie led Mitch into a study where they could be alone. Mitch noticed first two edition Steinbecks in the bookcase and what looked like an early Kandinsky on the walnut-paneled wall. The Grays' money troubles were evidently behind them. Connie saw him admiring the painting. It was a present. A very generous one.
Yes.
Connie smiled sweetly but didn't elaborate.
How can I help you, Detective?
Mitch decided to go for the direct approach. How long were you and Lenny Brookstein lovers? Blood rushed to Connie's face, then drained from it. She contemplated denying the affair, but thought better of it.
He obviously knows. Lying now will only anger him.
Not long. A few months. It was over before Nantucket, before he died.
Who ended it?
Connie picked up a silk cushion and dug her nails into the fabric.
He did.
That upset you? A vein in Connie's temple throbbed visibly.
A little. At the time, as you can imagine, Detective, this is not a chapter of my story which I'm particularly proud. Michael has no idea. Nor does Grace.
She does now. You lied to the police about your relationship.
I didn't lie. I concealed. I didn't see the point in dredging it all up. I still don't.
Mitch thought of Lenny's body, or what was left of it, dredged up from the bottom of the ocean. Did Connie have a hand in his death? The woman scorned? She had a cast-iron alibi for the day of the storm. Scores of people had seen the three Knoll sisters lunching together at the Cliffside Beach Club. But she could have orchestrated things behind the scenes.
What is it that you weren't proud of exactly? The affair? Or the fact that Lenny dumped you and went running back to Grace?
Mitch was trying to hit a nerve. If he succeeded in shaking Connie out of her queenly self-control, she might let something slip. It must have been humiliating, being rejected from your little sister.
I'll tell you what was humiliating, Detective. Lenny's ridiculous obsession with Grace. That was humiliating. For an intelligent, dynamic man like that to saddle himself with a half-witted child of a wife? It was laughable. It was pathetic.
The spleen dripped off Connie's tongue like venom.
Everybody thought so, not just me. Oh, we all paid homage, of course, fawned over the loving couple, but that marriage was a running joke.
You loved him, didn't you?
No.
You loved him, but he loved your sister.
He was obsessed with my sister. There's a difference.
Bullshit. Grace was the love of his life. You couldn't forgive either of them for that, could you, Connie? Reaching into her purse, Connie took out and lit a cigarette. She inhaled deeply and said,
"Let me tell you something, Detective. The only love of Lenny Brookstein's life was Lenny Brookstein. If you don't know that, you don't know the man at all."
But you knew him. You abased yourself, prostituted yourself for his pleasure, then got tossed aside like a used rag.
That's not true.
Admit it. You threw yourself at the guy's feet. The muscles in Connie's jaw visibly tightened. For a moment, Mitch thought she was finally going to lose it. But she reined in her temper. Stubbing out her cigarette, she said calmly, "You're quite wrong. If you must know, I hated Lenny Brookstein. Hated him."
"Is that why you had him killed?"
Connie burst out laughing. "Oh, dear! Is that what all this has been about, Detective?" She wiped away tears of mirth. "You found out about my affair with Lenny, and all of a sudden I'm the jilted lover on some murderous rampage? It's a little simplistic, don't you think?"
Mitch was angry. "I'll tell you what I think. I think you were there that weekend because you wanted revenge."
"Yes, indeed, and I got revenge." Standing up, Connie walked over to the painting Mitch had admired earlier, lifted it off the wall, and handed it to him. "A gift from my dear departed brother-in-law. A fake, as it happens, like him, but a pretty addition to the room, I'm sure you'll agree. I wanted it, so I made Lenny give it to me. I made Lenny give me a lot of things."
"You were blackmailing him, threatening to tell Grace about the two of you."
"Blackmailing him? Not at all." The suggestion seemed to surprise her. "I simply collected what I was owed." Walking around the room, admiring its array of rare books and objet d'art, Connie smiled contentedly to herself. "Michael, bless his heart, thinks I bought this house with inheritance money. He actually believes that a rich old aunt left me $15 million.
"Lenny gave you the money?"
"Who else? He wrote a check in Nantucket 2 days before he died. Thank God I cashed it promptly. A couple more weeks and that money would have been seized by Quorum's administrators. As it was..." She smiled smugly, leaving the sentence hanging. "I can say with my hand on my heart, Detective, that Lenny Brookstein's death was a grievous blow to me. But not because I adored him. I am nobody's victim. I leave that to my sister. She's so good at it, you see." Later that night, Mitch lay awake, thinking about Connie and Grace, about the man both women had loved. Lenny Brookstein was an enigma. He was not the caricature of evil that the press had made him out to be. Of that much, Mitch was sure. But neither was he the saint of his wife's imagination. What he appeared to be was a mess of contradictions. Generous and mean. Loyal and vengeful. Devoted and unfaithful. Brilliant at business, but unable to tell a friend from a foe. Had Lenny Brookstein really stolen all that money? He was capable of it. But had he done it? If so, the poor bastard never got to enjoy it. Someone had seen to that with a meat cleaver. Someone Lenny Brookstein knew and trusted. Bucola had provided some tantalizing leads, but all of them had wound up as dead ends. Andrew Preston, Jack Warner, Connie Gray. It was time to take another look at John Merrivale. Mitch fell asleep dreaming of stormy seas, Kandinsky paintings, and Grace Brookstein's haunting face. Chapter 26. The nausea came in waves. At first, Grace tried to ignore it. She was under stress. She wasn't eating properly. After Jasmine de Levine had told her about Connie and Lenny, she ran back to her miserable room, crawled into bed, and stayed there for 2 days. This was worse than Davy Bucola's betrayal, worse than being sent to Bedford, worse even than being raped.
She only got out of bed to use the toilet and to vomit. The vomiting was getting worse, both more frequent and more violent. She was getting sick.
It's probably a virus. I'm depressed. My immune system's low.
After 48 hours of unbearable nausea, Grace finally dragged herself to the Duane Reade on the corner. With a baseball cap pulled low over her eyes and a muffler covering the bottom half her face, she mumbled her symptoms to the pharmacist.
Uh-huh. When was your last period?
The question caught Grace by surprise.
My period?
Is there a chance you could be pregnant, sugar?
Grace tried to block out the sounds and images, but they kept coming. The van driver's face, his cruel, flat black eyes, his voice taunting her.
Don't worry, Lizzie. We've got all night.
No.
You're quite sure?
I'm positive. There's no chance.
Grace bought a pregnancy test. 10 minutes later, sitting on the broken toilet she shared with three other tenants, Grace peed on the stick for the requisite 5 seconds, mentally chiding herself for wasting $15.
This is ridiculous. I'm late because I'm exhausted.
2 pink lines appeared in the results window. Grace's palms began to sweat.
It must be a faulty test.
She ran back to the pharmacy and wasted another $15. Then another. Each time the white plastic stick taunted her, its pink lines dancing in front of her eyes like the elephants in Dumbo. Positive, positive, positive.
Congratulations! You are pregnant.
Grace felt dizzy. She slumped back on the bed and closed her eyes. Somehow, over these past 3 weeks, she'd managed to block out the rape. As if she knew instinctively that to let it in, to think about it, would destroy her. But now there could be no more hiding. It was here, inside her, growing and alive like some unwanted alien, a parasite consuming her from the inside out.
I have to get rid of it. Now.
A doctor was out of the question. Grace was already using the 3rd of the fake driver's licenses Karen had made for her at Bedford. This week, Grace was Linda Reynolds, a waitress from Illinois. The cards were good enough to fool sales assistants and hotel desk clerks who only glanced at them for a second. But Grace couldn't risk showing them to some doctor's officious assistant who might take a good, long look.
I'll have to do this myself.
Some of the girls in prison had talked about backstreet abortions, appalling, gruesome horror stories involving coat hangers and hemorrhages. Remembering them, Grace started to shake.
I can't. I can't go through with it. There has to be another way.
In a quiet corner of Queens Public Library, Grace sat at a computer. A quick Google search told her what she needed to know. Ingestion may cause gastrointestinal upset, spontaneous abortion, seizures, coma, disseminated intravascular coagulation, hepatic and renal injury and death.
Spontaneous abortion.
There was a health food store that sold herbs a few blocks away. Grace headed there.
The Romans used to use this, you know. The clerk at the store was in a chatty mood. It was a common herb for the cooking. Of course, what you have here is the essential oil. She passed Grace a thumb-sized glass bottle. You can't cook with this, not unless it's a stew for your mother-in-law and you're trying to kill her. Grace forced a smile. But a few drops in the tub? Amazing! Your troubles will melt away.
If only.
How much do I owe you?
That'll be $15.22. The clerk dropped the bottle into a paper bag and handed it to Grace. Suddenly, her face changed.
Do I know you from someplace? Your face looks familiar.
Grace pushed a $20 bill into her hand.
I don't think so.
No, I do. I'm sure I do. I never forget a face.
Keep the change.
Grace snatched the bag and ran out of the store. The clerk watched her go. It was terrible the way people in this city lived their lives in such a rush. She seemed like such a nice girl, too. Hopefully the oil would help her relax.
I'm sure I know her from somewhere.
Mitch Connors met John Merrill for lunch at a restaurant in Midtown Manhattan.
Thanks for meeting me.
John Merrill stood up and he smiled graciously. Mitch was struck by how slight he was. Everything about him seemed faint, from his colorless skin and watery gray eyes to his thin, reedy voice and limp handshake.
He's more ghost than man.
Not at all, Detective. I'm happy to help if I can. I assume this is about Grace.
Actually, it's about Lenny.
The gracious smile faded.
Oh.
I'd like him to get a better understanding of your relationship with him.
My relationship? I fail to see how my relationship with Lenny is of any relevance.
Mitch thought. That touched a nerve. Aloud, he said,
We're trying to build a complete as picture as we can of the Brooksteins' life before Grace was imprisoned. We're hoping it might help us to predict her movements now.
I see.
John sat down warily.
Shall we order?
Mitch opted for a steak and salad. John pursued the menu for an inordinate amount of time before deciding on the quiche.
Weak and insipid, like him, thought Mitch.
But there had to be more to John Merrill than that. You didn't get to the top of the food chain at an institution like Quorum unless you had a tough side, or at least some serious smarts.
You knew the Brooksteins as well as anyone, Mitch began. Grace even stayed with you and your wife during her trial, I believe.
That's correct.
And you paid for her defense.
Merrill looked uncomfortable.
I did. Lenny was my best friend. It was what he would have wanted.
But you never visited her in jail, never contacted her again, in fact. Why was that?
Try to understand, Detective. I believed in Grace for as long as I could, just like I believed in Lenny. But there came a point when I had to face the truth. They both let me down. I lost everything when Quorum collapsed. My good name, my savings, my life's work. I know there were others who suffered more than I did, and I'm devoting all my time now to trying to help those people.
You're talking about the FBI investigation?
Yes.
John nodded earnestly.
I'm still trying to make sense of it all myself.
Mitch thought, everything he says makes sense, so why don't I believe him?
The food arrived. Mitch devoured his steak hungrily. He watched John Merrill pick at his quiche Lorraine, taking tiny bites like a bird. When they'd finished eating, Mitch changed tack.
If you had to hazard a guess, where do you think Grace might be headed?
I have no idea.
Perhaps Lenny talked to you about some of the places he used to take her.
No, never!
Somewhere romantic. Somewhere that might have had significance for them as a couple.
I've told you, said John tersely. Lenny didn't talk to me about things like that.
Really? Mitch feigned surprise. I thought you said he was your best friend.
He was!
Your best friend never talked to you about his marriage? The most important thing in his life?
Grace wasn't the most important thing in Lenny's life, John snapped. I was!
Catching the look on Mitch's face, he blushed and began to backtrack.
Oh, well, not me personally. Quorum. Our work together. That's what Lenny lived for.
It was too late. The damage was done. Mitch thought, he sounds just like Connie Gray, like a jealous lover. The hairs on Mitch's forearms began to stand on end. Remind me, Mr. Merrivale, where were you the day of the storm on Nantucket? The day that Lenny Brookstein went missing? John blinked twice.
I was in Boston on business. It was a prearranged trip. I flew out early and I was gone all day. All my statements are in the file if you'd like to check them.
Thank you, said Mitch. I'll do that. It was only later, after he'd paid the check and John Merrivale had returned to work, that it struck him. He didn't stammer. When I asked him for his alibi that day, his speech was perfect. Grace lay back on the bed, the little bottle of oil in her hand. It smelled heady and comforting, like rosemary wafting on a warm summer breeze. The label said, "Warning, toxic, do not ingest." Grace thought about the bastard who had raped her. She thought about the innocent life inside her. She thought about Lenny. When she closed her eyes, she could hear his voice. "What about children? I suppose you'll want to be a mother." And her own.
"Not really. I'm happy as we are. There's nothing missing."
Lying on the bed, Grace realized that she had sacrificed motherhood for Lenny. She'd sacrificed everything for him, for their love, and she was still sacrificing. How could he have betrayed her with Connie? How? She felt angry and humiliated. She tried to hate him, to let go of his memory, but she couldn't.
"It's no use. I still love him. I'll always love him."
She opened the bottle and swallowed the bitter liquid.
"I wonder how long it will take."
"You okay in there, lady?"
The super was knocking on Grace's door.
"Do you need a doctor?"
Grace couldn't hear him. Pain tore through her body like a giant razor blade, slicing into her flesh, her nerves. She screamed. Blood poured out of her. Her limbs began to shake and dance as a seizure took hold of her body, contorting her arms and legs like a sadistic puppeteer. The super unlocked the door.
"Jesus Christ, I'm calling an ambulance!"
Grace didn't hear him. She was deafened by the sound of her own screams. Chapter 27. She heard voices.
"Linda? Linda?"
"Still no response. She's flatlining."
"Shock her again."
Grace wondered, "Who's Linda?"
She felt the weight of the paddles pressing on her ribs, then an indescribable pain like a kebab skewer being driven into her heart. She fainted. She was in a pale green room with a gray, checkered ceiling. There were needles in her arms. Someone was talking to her. A nurse.
Linda?
Grace remembered. She had to abandon Lizzie Woolley and moved on to another of her fake identities.
I'm Linda Reynolds. I'm a 32-year-old waitress from Chicago.
Welcome back.
The nurse smiled. Do you know where you are, Linda?
Hospital.
Grace's throat was so dry and sore, the word was barely audible.
Water.
Sure.
The nurse pressed a call button.
Just hold on a couple more minutes. The doctor will know whether it's safe for you to drink right now. He's on his way. Is there anyone else I can call for you, honey? A relative or a friend?
Grace shook her head.
Nobody.
She fell back to sleep. She was in East Hampton at a July 4th party. She was 6 years old. Her father had scooped her up in his arms and placed her on his shoulders. Grace felt like a princess in her powder blue, ruffled party dress with red, white, and blue ribbons in her blonde hair. One of her dad's friends called out to them.
Hey, Cooper, who's that gorgeous young lady you're with?
Only the prettiest girl in New York.
Cooper Knowles grinned.
When you get married, Gracie, it'll be to a king. You'll have the world at your feet, my angel. The world at your feet.
He tugged on her new blue party shoes. Grace laughed. The laugh turned into Lenny's laugh. They were on the terrace at their home in Palm Beach. Lenny was reading a newspaper.
Look at this, Gracie. He chuckled. You see what they're calling me? Leonard Brookstein, King of Wall Street. How does it feel to be married to a king?
It feels wonderful, my darling. I love you.
I love you too.
Linda? Linda!
The spell was broken.
This is Dr. Brewer. He's on our psychiatric team. He's just going to have a little chat with you, okay?
Days passed. Doctors and psychiatrists came and went. DIY abortions were a dime a dozen, sadly, but Linda Reynolds's case was unusual enough to attract attention.
Pennyroyal poisoning. What the fuck is that?
Some crazy herb. Women use it for abortions in medieval times, but it's gruesome. Ingesting the essential oil can cause renal failure, acute uterine hemorrhages, seizures.
The doctors told Grace it was a miracle she had lived. The pennyroyal had done its job of killing her baby, but her liver would be permanently weakened. Grace didn't care. She tried to cry for the baby, to feel sad for it, but she couldn't even do that. She knew if she looked back, she would crumble. All that mattered was that she was alive, recovering, growing stronger. She could feel it in her body. Soon, she would be able to get out of here. Her work was not yet done. In the hospital corridor, Juan Benitez whispered to his friend Jose Galel,
Ella, estoy seguro.
Jose poked his head around the corner of Grace's room.
No way.
Juan and Jose were both janitors. Not much exciting ever happened during their workdays mopping the hospital halls. But that was no reason for one to go making things up.
Ella es horrible.
Ugly, said Jose.
Grace Brookstein era hermosa.
Juan was insistent.
Le digo que es ella. ¿Quieres que la recompensa o no?
Jose thought about it. He did want the reward, badly, but he and his family were all in the States illegally.
He didn't want to be the guy who called the NYPD out on a wild goose chase. He looked at the patient again. With her newly shorn peroxide blonde hair, her pain-lined face and cold, listless eyes, she had none of the radiance of the beautiful young woman he'd seen on TV. And yet there was a resemblance. The doctors had told Grace she could walk around the room if she felt up to it. The electrolyte drip had been removed from her arm. Gingerly, Grace swung her feet to the floor. After a week in bed, her legs felt like jello. The Pennyroyal had given her seizures, one of which had torn a muscle in her calf. She hobbled to the window. In the parking lot below, a young couple were taking their newborn baby home. The father was wrestling with a car seat, a look of terrified anxiety on his face, while his wife calmly looked on, rocking the child in her arms. Grace smiled sadly. What a lovely, normal, happy family. I'll never have that. There was no time to dwell on her wistfulness. A police car pulled into the lot, then another. Suddenly, there were cops everywhere, swarming into the building like termites. Grace felt her heart rate jump. Are they looking for me? A blonde head emerged from one of the squad cars. Even before he looked up, Grace recognized his stocky, footballer player's physique. Mitch Connors. So they are here for me. Adrenaline coursed through her body. Think. There must be a way out. Mitch Connors got into the elevator. He was so tense he could hardly breathe. As if the prospect of finally catching Grace weren't overwhelming enough, he'd spent the last 3 days looking into John Merivale's cover story for the day Lenny Brookstein disappeared. He had so much to tell her, so much still to do. Seal off all exits and entrances. I want guys on the emergency stairs, in the kitchen, the laundry, everywhere.
Excuse me!
A furious chief resident stuck her arm in the elevator just as the doors were closing. In her 50s, with short gray hair and a steely "don't fuck with me" expression, she gave Mitch a piece of her mind.
What the hell is going on here? This is a hospital. Who gave you permission to come storming in here like this?
Mitch flashed her his badge, simultaneously pressing the button for the 6th floor. He should have alerted the hospital authorities, but with a tip this good, there was no time for niceties.
Sorry, lady. We have good information that Grace Brookstein is in the building, if you'll excuse me.
I won't excuse you. I don't care if Elvis Presley's in the building. My job is to save lives. You have no authority. Hey, get out of there!
Turning around, the chief resident saw 4 uniformed cops pushing open the swing doors to the OR. Seizing his chance, Mitch physically pushed her out of the elevator. The last thing he saw as the elevator doors closed was the furious doctor running toward him, shaking her fist like a cartoon villain. Grace had better be here. If she wasn't, he was in big trouble. Linda Reynolds, which room is she in? The staff nurse on the desk hesitated.
We're not supposed to give out patients' room numbers. Are you a family member?
Mitch flashed his badge.
Yeah, I'm her Uncle Mitchell. Where is she?
605, said the nurse. It's at the end of the hallway on your right.
Mitch was already running. He burst into the room, gun drawn.
Police, you're under arrest.
A terrified orderly put his hands in the air.
Jesus, what did I do?
Where is she? Grace.
The man looked blank. Mitch corrected himself.
I mean, Linda, the patient. Where did she go, damn it?
Bathroom.
the orderly stammered.
"Three doors down, she'll be right back."
Grace looked at the grate.